Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Beth Macy. Hello, Beth.
Hey, Vic. I'm so glad to be here.
Beth, I understand you've already done 17 interviews today, and I think you're probably the only person in the United States who has done that many interviews today. And it's probably because this book that you've just written is really getting some incredible buzz. It's called Factory Man.
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty lucky.
Wow, what's going on? How did this happen?
Well, I don't know. I wrote this newspaper article, and then I turned it into a book, and you know, the main character's kind of irresistible. I don't know if you've had the chance to read the whole thing, but he's pretty much a renegade, an outlier. He tried to save his industry. That didn't really work out, but he was able to save his factory and 700 jobs in a tiny town you've probably never heard of called Galax, Virginia, and that factory means the world to the people there.
Well, actually, I have heard of Galax. You know how I've heard of it?
Fiddler's Convention.
I read your book.
Oh, I love that. Thank you for reading my book.
Yeah, it's about a guy named Tom Friedman, right?
You'd be shocked at how many of the interviewers haven't read my book, but anyway,
yeah, well,
that's another story.
The world is not flat.
That's what a lot of the displaced workers who are still unemployed, still cobbling together their living by some of them growing their own food, many of them working part-time at the only job they could find, which is Walmart. That's what they think.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying globalization is all bad. I mean, somebody asked me in an interview, are you the anti-Tom Friedman? and you know, I have nothing against Tom Friedman. I think his book, The World is Flat, is really good. Like, when he wrote it, that was all super big news, and he was on the cutting edge of it. Mm-hmm. And he was writing about this dynamic, enormous global change, and he really did a good job explaining it. But And maybe it wasn't yet as clear to everybody as it is now, but a whole lot of people got hurt by globalization, and they got very little ink in that book. And this is kind of that's why I set out to write the story to begin with. That was a newspaper series, and by that writing that series, it was how I learned about John Bassett and what he had done in taking on China at the U.S. International Trade Commission. And that's how I got to where I am today. I mean, maybe it's accurate to call me the anti-Tom Friedman, but I think he doesn't give a lot of ink to a lot of people who are still hurting. You know, we had 63,300 factories closed between 2001 and 2012, and I know several of them were in your region around Dayton and Springfield, Yellow Springs area.
More than several.
Yeah.
Well, Tom still gets his regular paycheck every week, so we're not going to bash Tom Friedman. My guest is Beth Macy. Her book is Factory Man, and you know a little bit about this area, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I grew up in Urbana at 429 South Walnut Street, and, you know, it's kind of a typical small factory town. I mean, it was when I grew up. Grimes was the sugar daddy, Grimes Manufacturing. They made airplane lights. And my mom worked for them when the economy was good, and when it wasn't good, which was sometimes frequently in the 1970s, she would get laid off, and then she would babysit other people's kids. And one time she waitressed, and not very well, she says. And times were tough. Part of it, the issue in my family is my dad was serially unemployed. He was an alcoholic. He was a house painter, and I came along late in his life, and he was in pretty bad shape by the time I was growing up. And so that created a lot of financial struggle. My mom kept the family together. My grandmother next door kept the family together. But all of which is sort of an entree to say why I kind of fell in love with some of these people who were giving me their phone numbers to call and then giving me their mother's phone numbers because they knew their own phone was about to cut off. I mean, I've remembered what that felt like.
So how did you become a reporter in Virginia? How did you make that transition in your life and stumble upon this story?
Yeah, so I went to college at Bowling Green State University, way up 75, and I was the first person in my family to go. I was my dad died when I was a sophomore in college and was not working by the time I had at all. He had cancer and was disabled, and My mom made $8,000 a year test driving cars for a Honda subcontractor. And because we had so little income, I was able to go to college basically for free. I even got a Pell Grant. I got some scholarships. I had been a good student. And I was able to go for free because college tuition was pretty low back then. I went from 1982 to 1986. I graduated from journalism. I worked a little bit in Columbus. Then I worked in Savannah. And then pretty early on, I moved to Roanoke. It was 1989. And I just never left. And I remember a journalism teacher at BG saying, "You'll know you've arrived as a journalist when you can walk into a diner or a bar or coffee shop and not only know a couple people there, but you'll be able to get some good story ideas out of them." And I think when I came to Roanoke, I thought, oh, it's a kind of a mid-sized city. I'm not going to stay here very long. But I met my husband here, and it was just a great place to raise kids. And the upside to this, and this is why I'm taking so long to get to this, is the upside of staying in one community for so long is you really get to know the people, and you really get to see stories unfold. And so I was able to sort of track what was happening in the furniture industry. It's about an hour south of where I live, actually, in Martinsville and Henry County. I was able sort of to track it from afar just because my colleagues were going down there and covering all the factory closings. The last big closing was 2010, by the way. First the textiles went, starting in the 90s, and then the furniture factories, and the last of them closed in 2010. And so the question that drove me and a photographer I was collaborating with at the time was, how are this one region, which has the highest unemployment rate in the state for over a decade now, lost half of its workforce? I mean, just 19,000 jobs went away.
Mm.
And how are those people now? Because you don't see them at the Employment Commission because their employment is long run out. I mean, it's not like you can go to the displaced worker store to interview them. And so a lot of the book was just trying to find out where they were, how they were doing, what happened to them. And during the course of that, somebody said, well, you know, there's a guy still making furniture. And that was 70 miles the other direction. And the story was just loaded with intrigue from the moment that I'd heard about it. And I realized that it had big legs. You know, I realized it extended all the way around the globe, and it allowed me to tell the social history of one industry and also to sink my teeth into a really juicy profile and also to just sort of answer for myself, what happened here? Man, why is this place like a ghost town? And because I didn't really understand until I peeled back all the layers. So that's what I'm hoping the book does, like for people. Like maybe your mom grew up in a factory town and she knows China's the wicked enemy, or the CEOs who are the only ones still going to work are the wicked enemy. But, you know, maybe she can read my book and really understand it from a more deeper way, like what happened.
This is a big, juicy story, and your central character, your factory man, you've gone down and you've track down all the information you could about his family, about this amazing culture around the furniture industry that was happening for generations. And it's very entertaining and very informative. I didn't know anything about the furniture industry, and now I feel like I know a little bit.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I didn't know anything about it either. I'm actually sitting right now in my neighbor's house, because I don't have a landline and I've been doing all these radio interviews, they wanted a landline. I'm sitting in the house of a furniture store owner named Joel Shepard. He owned Virginia Furniture Market. And I knew so little about furniture that when I set out to write this story about what had happened to this community, I thought, well, who do I know that can kind of fill me in on the backstory? And so I asked my neighbor Joel, whose house I'm sitting in right now, if I could take him out to breakfast and just pick his brain. And you know, it took him like 2 hours. We were there a long time. He's explaining, you know, creative destruction. He's explaining what happened to his industry. I mean, and he sells mostly imports.
Mm-hmm.
And I had bought some of those imports. I mean, he gives me a family discount, the neighbor discount. And he explained it all, but from a really kind of nuanced, very smart point of view. And he's the one that told me about John. And kind of set me on this path, which is interesting. But it's a complicated story.
I'll say.
It hurt my brain.
Well, it's a big, thick book, and it's generating lots of buzz. The book is officially coming out today, but you've already had two very nice pieces about it in the New York Times, and you actually contacted me by email, but I had heard about the book before because someone on Facebook who I don't know sent me a message saying, hey, Beth Macy, she's from Urbana. She's got this book coming out, this hot book. You got to know about it. And I was just like, wait a minute. It's like, you know, and that was the first inkling that I had about the book. And then I read it and I thought, oh, there's just so much here. I didn't know Alvin Barkley dropped dead like that. I had never heard of the Smith River Twitch.
He's kind of like Forrest Gump, right?
Yeah.
What about Dalian, that whole thing about Dalian and that Chinese Communist Party official's buddies with Bo Xilai? I mean, what are the chances of that?
That's amazing.
Right? It's like, it is like Forrest Gump. It just cracks me up.
If you'd like to meet Beth, she's actually coming back through the area on her book tour, and she's got a couple of events in our area. She's coming back to her hometown of Urbana, but first she's going to be at Books and Company in Beaver Creek on Tuesday, August 12th at 7 o'clock for an event, a book signing for her new book, Factory Man. And then she'll be at the Champaign County Public Library in Urbana on Thursday, August 14th at 7 o'clock. You can meet her. And I'm sure that we have listeners up there in Urbana who are going, Beth Macy, I remember her. She was.
I didn't think she'd amount to anything. So I was on Fresh Air, and somebody sent me an email that I'd gone to high school with. And he said, I had no idea it was you. And then I heard your laugh, and it had to be you.
Oh.
So funny. So, hadn't heard from me in 30 years.
Give us a capsule. For folks who are thinking, you know, I think this book sounds interesting. I'd like to read it. Give us a capsule view of what's in it.
Yeah. So it's the story of globalization told through this one furniture family, which is, I mean, if you grew up in the 70s and 80s and you ever watched Let's Make a Deal, they would give away, they would say, behind door number three is a Bassett furniture suit.
Uh-huh.
It was that kind of thing, like you would see it in Look and Life magazines of the doctor's office and things like that, but I didn't know what it was. So it's kind of, it's the story about globalization told through the Bassett family and the two very different turns they took in response to it. So Bassett Furniture, which is not the company John runs at all, it's the company, he was born in the company town of Bassett, which was very much a company town, unincorporated. The workers actually paid their electric bills at the corporate offices, which the line workers jokingly called the Taj Mahal.
Mm.
And, the company / family ran everything about that town. So, and it was a public company, and when globalization hit, the company tried to fight back. They even joined John Bassett's coalition, to the anti-dumping coalition, but ultimately they chose to close all of their Bassett factories. And this was totally a factory town with seven different factories along the Smith River that ran through town. And they're pretty much all closed, most of them torn down with grass planted. They're like these manicured rectangles encased in, you know, fencing. That's what Bassett looks like, with lots of closed shops and whatnot. And the Taj Mahal is still there and very much operating, with marketing people and people who coordinate their offshoring stuff. They do have an upholstery plant that's a pretty sizable in Newton, North Carolina, and they have an assembly plant in Martinsville, Virginia. So they do still have two factories, but they've gone from having 10,000 employees to 1,500. And they, in response, what the CEO told me was that they were getting a lot of guff from their shareholders who were watching the profits drain, and so they closed the factory in response to that. They tried to compete, but what they did instead, and there's a real shift in the company's kind of path forward when they decide to go vertical, which is they started stores, and they now have, I think, 90-some stores all over the country called Bassett Home Furnishings. And they sell mainly their imported products, but they also sell these kind of, the consumer can go in and on a computer with the help of a design person, she can design the kind of couch or chair she wants, choosing from hundreds, maybe even thousands of different fabrics. And that factory in Newton will make them one at a time custom. So that's kind of, you can say that that's what exists. Either the wood furniture is like John Bassett's and Galax that never closed to begin with, or the things that kind of specialize in custom upholstered and like kitchen cabinet plants. You'll still see them around this region.
But
most of the rest of the wood furniture making, unless it just never closed to begin with, is gone. And maybe coming back, but John opened a vacant plant that was next to him in 2012, I believe it was. And he's trying to expand. He thinks when the housing market rebounds, he will be poised to grow because he's the last one standing. And that was his goal all along when this began.
He's the factory man. Beth Macy wrote about him in her new book. And on the top of the book, it says, how one furniture maker battled offshoring, stayed local, and helped save an American town. It's a feel-good story, but there's just so much here, so many different stories, all these dramas. I love the story about how John was pushed out of running the factory and the business by his brother-in-law, Bob Spillman, and how Bob was chosen. That's such an interesting story.
It's just so universal, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
His sister was older than him, and Bob was, of course, older than him, and he was hired to work for the company, started out running the table plan, I think it was, and they saw he's this really hard-charging executive. He had flown to California, and I love that scene where the CEO says to John's brother, he's already flown to California, and Doug and I haven't even done that yet. So he came, he had been working Connecticut, New York, and that impressed them, and he really impressed the big wigs. And then when John's father died unexpectedly, relatively young, the story is by many people, including some members of the board, that his daughter, Jane, convinced him to anoint her husband as the heir apparent. And whether or not that happened, different people have different feelings about it, but it's exactly what happened. And at which point, Bob Spillman and the other person who was running it, whose name was Ed Bassett, kind of conspired to shove Little John, as they called him dismissively, out of the company and out of the town. And, he tried to keep going. They sent him to Mount Airy to get a factory going. And by the time he got back 2 years later, they had taken all of his stuff out of the corporate office and set him up in a little strip mall with no secretary. That was humiliating. But, that's like that kind of stuff happens in all families. This family just happened to have a lot of money and power. And so it feels a little more interesting, but it's really just a very universal story, I think.
You also get into the racial dynamics in this community, and that's really fascinating to read about. And a lot of other issues, like I alluded to it before with the Smith River Twist, something they called culling up and down the river, and I'll leave that to readers to figure out what that's all about. But this was intriguing.
Thank you. Thank you. I call it Mad Men in the Mountains with Moonshine instead of Martinis. I mean, it was like, I'm sure a lot of businesses were run that way. Sexual harassment was rampant. Of course, African Americans weren't treated very well. Bassett was, forced by court order to desegregate the departments. For decades they had run it where, the African Americans ran the finishing lines because they were already dark. So what did it matter if they got spray on them, And, I mean, it's just the way it was. But when you dig in and when you interview some of these people who worked in the factories who were black and who are black, and they recall being harassed by their managers at lunch, and there was no recourse other than, I don't know if you remember the one story where the woman, actually her grandmother, who had been a maid in the Bassett house, told her, well, I don't care what you do, but you can't take that from him. So she put a switchblade in her pocket, and the next day at lunch when he threatened to rape her, as he had been doing for weeks, she pulled it out, and she got in his face. And he said, whoa, 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 I'm just kidding. And she said, and that's when I learned you didn't get anything in life by keeping quiet. And she's now the head of the NAACP in Martinsville and Henry County. She's quite a leader and quite an activist.
These domestics describe being in these household situations, and the wife would go out, and then suddenly the husband would say, "I want you to come over here." "Well, why didn't you want me to come over there when your wife was still home?" Yeah, pretty dark stuff.
Pretty dark stuff, and you know it went on. You know it went on all over. Somebody had told me early on when they knew what I, and it was somebody I really respect who's written a lot of books. And he actually just published a book called MJ the Life. It's the definitive biography of Michael Jordan, which goes deep into the history of sharecropping and Jordan's great-grandparents and all this. And he's really into the same kind of history stuff that I'm in. He said, "I'll give you one piece of advice. Find the 80 and 90-year-olds.
Uh-huh.
And it was so true, because anytime I stumbled upon somebody in that age group, I mean, they had witnessed such history. Four of my main sources in the book died before the book came out, which makes me really sad, including the woman who said, "Well, you know, why didn't you tell me that before your wife left?"
Mm-hmm.
She passed away in November. And these are amazing people with stories, and but they're regular people, so nobody's really asked them to be interviewed before. And it's like anything. They've got a story to tell, too.
Well, I can tell this book took a while to write because, number one, it's big. It's thick. And I can see where you actually receive what they're calling the J. Anthony Lucas Work in Progress Award, which I'm thinking is some sort of a wonderful award that allows a writer to actually be able to keep working on a book.
It was awesome.
Right?
I had just been to Indonesia with my husband because I was following the jobs. Where were these furniture jobs now? And they were in Indonesia. And we had just charged the whole trip. And we were actually, I hadn't had my cell phone on in 10 days. I was in the Chicago airport, and I turned it back on, and there's this message from Columbia University, which administers the award, and it was a $30,000 prize. And I really hate debt. I just hate debt. But I knew I couldn't write a book about globalization without going to Asia and seeing, you know, what it looked like from and interviewing those line workers who were happy to join the cash economy 100 years later after the people in the American South did. And so I was just about to have to put this giant charge account bill on my equity line and when I found out I won that award. So that was really, really awesome and really helped me complete it and to take a little bit extra time at the end for fact-checking. And it was just great. I'm very grateful to the Lucas Linton Prize. And, you know, J. Anthony Lucas wrote Common Ground, which was a great book about poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just very honored to be in the same sentence with him.
Beth Macy joins us. Her new book is Factory Man. It was officially published today. This book is generating lots of buzz, and she is going to be in our area. She'll be at Books & Company for a book signing on Tuesday, August 12th at 7 o'clock in Beaver Creek in the Green. And she's coming back to her hometown, Urbana, Ohio, the place she grew up. She'll be at the Champaign County Public Library on Thursday, August 14th. At 7 p.m., and I imagine you'll see a lot of familiar faces there, maybe a little older than the last time you saw them.
I have to say that I lived right up the street. I told you I lived on Walnut Street. The library used to be in this beautiful little brick building right down the hill from where I lived, and I fell in love with language and writing in that tiny library.
Oh.
So it's really cool. I get to have circle back and have this moment. And my high school English teacher who encouraged me is going to be there. It's really cool.
That's pretty neat. So, what was the process for you as far as how did you get a book deal? How did you get this thing to be noticed?
Mm-hmm. Well, good old-fashioned reporting. I had been a Nieman Fellow, which helped a lot. I had a lot of contacts. After my Nieman year, I knew a lot of people. They were good friends of mine who had written books, right? So it sort of gave me some connections, which was nice.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, I found my agent through a friend of mine at the Roanoke Times who had written a wonderful book called If Trouble Don't Kill Me. And it came out maybe 5 years ago. It's a great book. And his name's Ralph Barrier, Jr., and a lot of my Nieman friends helped me with kind of the, here's how you write a book proposal and this kind of thing. But Ralph actually, you know, introduced me to his agent, who became my agent. And his name's Peter McGuigan. He runs a literary agency called Foundry in New York. And he's just brutally thorough. He loved the book initially. He read it, and he emailed me right away, and he wrote, "Holy bleep, you've stumbled upon Moneyball with furniture."
Mm.
And he was really excited about it. And he was from Virginia, and his dad had worked at Lane Furniture. And his enthusiasm, because I was interviewing a couple different agents at the time, and his enthusiasm just showed me, like, he's got what it takes to sell this book. And he did. He sold it. We had a couple offers, but we ended up going with Little Brown and Company, which, as you know, is 175 years old. And it's just a great publisher to work with.
I was reminded reading your book of something that happened to a friend of mine. He moved to Alaska, and he fell in love with a woman who was a native Alaskan, and they came back to the hometown of Des Moines to meet his parents, and he was really in love with her. He was ready to marry her, and his parents got her a plane ticket, put her back on the plane, and sent her back to Alaska, and that was the end of it. And you have something that happened very much like that in this book, and it happened to your protagonist, and he didn't like talking about that one thing, did he?
No, he really didn't. And he loves his wife. He loves his wife, and his wife is a fabulous person.
Uh-huh.
But you know, he didn't want to talk about that one. And I didn't know that I was going to find the German girlfriend that he had met when he was busily guarding the German the construction of the Berlin Wall.
Uh-huh.
Way back when, and but a lot of people knew the story, and it is sort of heartbreaking. But you know, he has had a very nice life with his wife, and just another little kind of human wrinkle in the story.
Mm-hmm. There are so many of them, and not only are there so many great stories, but they're being told by a really wonderful storyteller named Beth Macy, who's been my guest on the program today. You really know how to tell a yarn.
Oh, thanks, Vic. I really appreciate it.
And you've still got a little energy left after 17 interviews.
I'm having a book launch party tonight. I'm super excited. I got a new dress. I got a beer. I have to tell you this. Maybe you could get some of the bars in Yellow Springs to carry it. But our friends have a new craft brewery called Parkway, and they have launched this new session IPA called Factory Girl as a tie-in to my book. So we're having the book launch party at the brewery tonight, so I'm super excited.
And a session IPA is the kind of thing that you can drink and still do a radio interview.
Exactly.
Right?
Uh-huh. Exactly. How do you know, Vic? God, do you have like, is this like scratch and sniff radio or something? You knew?
You know, I know what a session beer is. I know it's lower alcohol. So.
It was actually coined in the 1800s by British factory workers.
Oh.
Who could have a beer during the break and still go back and like not trip over the equipment.
Nice. Well, yep. We really appreciate your time today.
Oh, I do too. I enjoyed talking to you. It's great to cross paths with you, and maybe we'll see each other in Yellow Springs someday, which is I always visit when I go home to see my mom.
Sounds good. My guest has been Beth Macy. Her new book is Factory Man. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Thanks for listening. Next week, John Dean will be my guest. His book is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. John Dean was there. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.